Hey there, thank you for joining me here today on 2SER. My name is Andrew Popel. You have tuned in to Final Draft, which is books, writing and literary culture. It is great to find you here, and I am very keen to talk about a new Australian book release. As we get started, I want to acknowledge that 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I want to acknowledge that I am actually recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people, and that these lands are unceded lands. I pay my respects to the traditional owners of those lands and their ongoing connection to the land. Now, as always, every week, Final Draft is going to be about books, writing and literary culture. And today I have a fantastic new novel from crime writer A.W. Hammond. This book is called The Paris Collaborator, and it's going to take us back in time and it's going to take us across the world. And as we get started, it occurred to me that it's a fantastic new release that is going to concern itself with a historical period. I jumped on it because I really was kind of looking for this idea of mental escape. And what I found was that by reflecting on history and historical events, but also the mindsets that people were in at the time, it gave me new insights on the world that we're living in right now. The Paris Collaborator takes place in the dying days of the occupation of Paris in the Second World War. And it is really this genre-bending, noir, detective-style fiction that riffs on the ideas of what it meant to be loyal and what it meant to follow an ideology in those days of war. If you're starting to see where these parallels might find themselves today, I am very excited to share this story. The Paris Collaborator has so much to offer on so many levels. It is what I've got coming up today on the show. So thank you for joining me here on Final Draft. And I'm going to be joined by Alex Hammond after this short break.
Carve on 2SER, your weekly exploration into all things arts and culture, right here in Sydney.
Tune in every Saturday morning from 11 to listen to interviews from Sydney's leading artists, musicians, comedians, thespians and filmmakers.
Our live performance segment means you hear poignant live performances by established and up-and-coming creatives straight to your ears. Carve, arts and culture, for everyone. Saturday mornings from 11.
The end of financial year is approaching fast. Remember to make your tax-deductible donation to 2SER before June 30 so that you can claim it back. Head to 2SER.com now and follow the links to donate to 2SER before June 30. Thanks for supporting 2SER.
You are on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It is books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel, and I want to introduce to you a fantastic new novel that, as I began, thought was going to be a little bit of literary travel for the mind. And as I got into it, I realized there were so many ideas that were engaging with our world today. I am joined on the show by A.W. Hammond, and we are going to be discussing The Paris Collaborator. Alex, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. It's wonderful to be here.
Now, I just want to introduce you a little bit more properly here. You trained and worked as a lawyer before penning your Ned Kelly Award-nominated novel, Blood Witness. You're also the author of The Unbroken Line, but today we are traveling a little bit further afield in the novel The Paris Collaborator. It's Paris, August 1944. Auguste Duchesne is renowned for his ability to find missing people. Now he finds himself in an impossible situation. As the Allies close in on Paris, Duchesne must find a missing priest and a German soldier. Working both sides against the other, he must somehow satisfy two masters to protect his family. So I thought perhaps we could start with Duchesne. He's an ex-soldier, a veteran of the trenches of the First World War. He's a teacher with a tragic history that means he no longer steps into a classroom. He's also something of the archetype of the classical detective. He's both got hard-boiled elements, and he's a little bit golden age with his keen perceptions. In your previous work, you've taken a more, I guess, contemporary take on the mystery and the detective. What drew you to all of the intersecting genres that make up Duchesne and The Paris Collaborator?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think from where I was coming from with the earlier books, which are obviously, as you said, a contemporary setting with a lawyer who investigates. I was trying to find a way to sort of basically had this idea about the setting and how I wanted to put a character in a classic kind of conundrum of detective fiction, which is the, you know, two competing cases at the same time, and then the setting of occupied Paris sort of immediately lent itself to two oppositional forces in, within that, right? So we've got the Nazis who've occupied Paris and the resistance who are resisting them. And they reflect sort of two extremes, you know, authority and control, armed resistance and conflict. And working for either one of those would be a dangerous circumstance for this sort of, as you have pinpointed, a sort of detective character. But then having him have to work simultaneously for both of them, just up the drama, up the risk, up the sort of challenge, and then allowed me to play with sort of those moral questions around collaboration. So, yeah, so it was sort of looking at the tropes of detective fiction in some way. And without giving away too much of the book, I mean, inevitably in these sorts of stories, the two competing cases merge, and that just would only seek to heighten the drama and risk for that character. So there was part of that. We've also got the question of his name, and I was sort of evoking the historical character of Edgar Allan Poe's character, C. Auguste Dupin, who is attributed, Poe is attributed to writing the first detective story when he wrote Murders in the Rue Morgue. And drawing from that is where some of those more classical ideas come across. So Conan Doyle actually took Poe's character, C. Auguste Dupin, and it's what he references in The Study in Scarlet. He mentions the detective Dupin over in Paris. And then he also took that aspect of Dupin, which is fine attention to detail, and built that into Holmes. So he acknowledges his source. And in the same way, I'm sort of harkening back to that. So that's where you get that sort of classic element of the highly observant detective who notices things that other people don't know, which makes him so good at that. But then also trying to make that a bit more of a believable character in a real world setting. So he is a survivor of a bombing, and his classroom, he's a former teacher, you know, and his classroom was bombed and he is the only survivor. And so he's suffering with the survivor's guilt. So his motivation for going out and finding these lost children in a war zone is one of wanting to make amends for that sense of guilt that he has. So it's trying to ground it in a very sort of modern psychological premise.
The story is set in the week before the liberation of occupied Paris. The situation is extreme, but you also seek to explore some of the simplicity of life in these moments. Can you tell me about evoking Paris in this time of war? Because it's both an extraordinarily well-documented period, but also perhaps something of a mystery for us in the day-to-day of street level.
Yes, you're quite right. There's a lot of firsthand accounts in the form of a lot of letters that have been written by people who were there living in Paris during the occupation. And then there's a lot of secondhand sources. So there's a lot of research that's been done and sort of from the range of full academic text through to sort of more approachable ones, which were the ones that I read, just like the more approachable ones. I sort of lent a lot on the photography of the time because there were a number of photographers documenting everything and the sort of the day-to-day experience of what it would have been. But yeah, then it's just about, I mean, I find that when I approach writing and to sort of evoke the world, I'm leaning on other genres actually, more so than crime fiction or historical. I'm thinking more towards fantasy and science fiction and what they do, well, less hard science fiction, but more soft science fiction, when the world building that they do. And, you know, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from those and how to effectively evoke a world setting. So, you know, there's always the challenge between wanting to put every single piece of research that you've discovered and drop it into the book and basically sort of try and almost, you know, write every fascinating thing down, that almost as if you're sort of trying to write another, you know, piece of nonfiction around what it was like, and balancing that against how much you include to keep the story moving forwards and serve the story. But yeah, I couldn't turn away from some things. Like, I was absolutely fascinated by the buses in Paris in the 40s, their headlamps were blue, you know, and I had to put that in there because it's so strange. Or looking a lot of advertising at the time to sort of see what sort of products. So if I'm looking up what kind of beer, you're looking at historical advertising, sort of draw, or cigarettes, you know, there's a whole sub-thread in cigarettes and what sorts of cigarettes people are smoking it each time, and when the American cigarettes are turning up, and the German cigarettes and the French cigarettes, you know. So, yeah, it was enjoyable, and it was certainly there was a lot of first-hand sources in the form of photography that really helped lend to that. I mean, I'm struck with one photo in particular where it's at Montmartre, which is, you know, the artist commune, where Moulin Rouge is there, but a lot of the artists have their garrets in that area, and so it attracted a lot of tourists, you know, throughout the 19th and 20th century to go there, and they would sit and paint on easels the sort of skyline looking down because it's at the top of the hill, so you get this, you know, amazing view of Paris. And the Germans are no different. So, you know, they were being sent there on R&R in order to attend, you know, Paris and enjoy its cultural treasures. And there's all these amazing photos of Parisians sort of walking past on the street trying to get about their daily business while they're very aware of the presence of an occupying force. And there's that occupying force sitting at easels, sipping coffees, trying to, you know, act like they're tourists while they're in full uniform in front of everybody. So it's quite surreal. And also just such rich sort of atmosphere to build into a novel.
Let's jump into the plot, where Duchesne's twin missions, they place him squarely in the center of the seething conflict on the streets of Paris. By working for both the resistance and the Germans, he's between these two poles of political thought and action. Now, we find ourselves, I guess, similarly, living in times of extremes of ideology. Was that at all on your mind as you wrote?
It absolutely was. I think it would have been difficult to write in that setting and ignore the occupied Paris and this idea of collaboration and what being a collaborator meant, because it was so front of mind for everybody, the Parisians, and I guess also the Germans, in the sense of that the resistance from the French. Also at the same time, I mean, we had a former president in the United States who I don't like to actually continue to use his name now that he's out of office, but there were these extremes of ideology, you know, and I think very much when it comes to, if you're looking at, you know, National Socialism and Nazism, it's too easy to just assume, and I'm guilty of this myself, you sit around going, well, that's not possible, that would never happen again. I mean, it was obviously so abhorrent at the time, and yet you see that there's this more and more growing stark contrast between ideology over rationalism. And I guess that's sort of what I'm exploring in the book. And it mirrors with now, you know. I mean, I'm often reflect on, you know, and this is just sort of how my brain works, moving around, looking at things. But the internet should be this amazing resource of facts and education and information for people in a way that is unparalleled in human history. And yet it increasingly seems to be becoming a thing for, you know, people factionalizing and holding on to ideological ideas and opinion over evidence, you know, and then, you know, the extremes of that sort of in the echo chamber of isolated groups, you know, building up. And so, yeah, I think that was playing through my mind absolutely when I was writing about it.
I was struck by the breakdown in civility. As Duchesne rides the metro, he gives up his seat to a woman. And as she says, thank you, it turns out she's German. She has a German accent. Duchesne is then made a pariah for the rest of his journey. People turn their backs on him. They hiss. Do you think that this is a sort of a fundamental shift in these times of extreme, that we lose some of our kindness? Or is there an aspect of performance here where people must be seen to be a member of the right side?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's spot on. I think it's two things. So that's actually drawn from the writing of the time. So when a lot of pamphlets were distributed around resisting the occupation, and sort of the citizenry and of Paris were encouraged to not directly resist through action and put their lives at risk, but resist through silence, not to aid the Germans by providing direction to them, or, you know, so, and the Germans wrote about this as well. You know, you had these sort of, you can only imagine, conscripted, somewhat naive young men being sent to Paris on R&R, expecting to be you know, helped and given directions and, you know, because they're on R&R, they don't see that as part of being this sort of a war zone for them. And writing back about how cold the Parisians were towards them. But I think you're right, like that was then became the signals that were needed to be broadcast from Parisian to Parisian that, you know, I am, although subtly, but importantly, resisting this occupation.
It drew me back to what you were just mentioning there, this, you know, in our age of the internet, seemingly we have a platform that should be so much a space of connectivity, but we see exactly the same thing happening where we have performances of the side that we are on that absolutely descend into, you know, baseness, this idea that one person's act of kindness or one person's act of solidarity can then be leapt on so vehemently. And it was these parallels that just kept drawing me back into what Duchenne was actually trying to achieve in this mission. So he is brought in by the resistance. They charge him with finding a priest. Or realistically, they want him to find some guns. But, you know, he is famous for finding people, so he has to find a priest. He is then brought in by the Germans, and they want him to find a soldier. And he doesn't know what to do. He has got these twin missions. They are polar opposites. And he doesn't want any of this. He wants to be the man that he is, but he's challenged by the German major who charges him with his mission. How are you not one of us? And it's a question of increasing importance that complicates Duchenne's life immeasurably, because as the Americans approach Paris and the Nazis redouble their efforts, it seems that everyone must choose a side, and by doing so, they place a bet on their future. And there was, you show us this thin line between being an ally or a collaborator. The side you choose makes you an ally or a collaborator, depending on who wins. And only from our point in history do we know. Would it have been possible to be neutral in such times? Like Duchenne sort of, he kind of tries to maintain a little bit of neutrality in his mission of finding people.
Yeah, from the research that I did, and that was through a very specific lens in writing this story, it didn't seem to me that neutrality was a possibility. Mm. It was so pervasive, the sense of the presence of others, you know, and I mean this, you know, literally, but also in more broadly, the foreign presence of the Germans, that there was this strong expectation that you would take a side. I think particularly too, because Paris had, you know, for whatever, for the reasons that many people are familiar, had chosen to, you know, essentially become this, you know, there was Vichy France, so it was supporting the Germans essentially there. And there's even historical examples of French Nazis who went and became and joined the SS. The SS battalion Charlemagne were their name, and they actually fought in the fall of Berlin. So Paris had long since been liberated. The French were now solidly ally, you know, reunited, and there were still, you know, French fighting in Berlin some years after that. So I think it was very stark. And one of the ideas, I think, is, you know, and we're talking about Duchenne quite a bit, but I try to also sow this theme of what is collaboration throughout the book, or even, you know, a shopkeeper. What does it mean for them to sell food to, you know, to the Germans? Are they supporting the Germans? Should they be refusing? I mean, they obviously can't, but at the same time, is that sort of seems to be more permissible in the sense of, well, that's their business and they have no other choice. You know, they can't resist. And there's, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but there's sort of ways that plays out in the story. And then also looking at the, you know, Duchenne's daughter who falls in love with a German airman, and that whole experience for women and the men, I guess, as well, potentially, who found themselves, you know, German lovers, which early on might have seemed like, well, this is the way it's going to be, you know, because as you say, nobody had the benefit of historical hindsight to say, well, this isn't going to only be, you know, 4 years worth of our experience. But I think the other thing too is I've tried to play with that idea of the benefit of historical hindsight, because we know the outcome. So the tension is amped up for us, knowing that actually some of these decisions and what's going on puts them at threat, you know, particularly Marianne, his daughter. I mean, you know, it's so vivid and well known, you know, the images of women having their hair shorn and carrying, you know, babies, you know, presumably who the fathers were Germans, you know, through the streets of Paris and being beaten and hounded. So you know what's at risk. You know, we know what's at risk for these characters.
There's so much more to say that we can't say. We could do this interview again in a year or 18 months' time when more people have read it and we can discuss more of the mystery. But maybe a final question just to think a little bit about Duchenne. In your mind, as you were writing, did you feel the resolution hinged more on Duchenne's success or that others would perceive his success? You set up the idea in the title, The Paris Collaborator. Is it more important that Duchenne is successful or that he is not denounced as a collaborator?
That's a really interesting question. I think for him, by the end of the book, it becomes about the survival of those who he cares about. And it's almost as if his survival is less important. So he sort of made a decision in his mind there. But it does hinge sort of at the end in some ways too about, you know, again, without giving too much away, once some of the questions and challenges and threats have been resolved, how does he has to then come back to return into that world of like, I might actually get through this. And then how do I get through this without being labeled a collaborator? Mm. I think that's quite important for him. But I also think that question remains sort of hanging too, because it's just sort of uncertain about how things are going to progress for him in some ways after we land on the last page. But for me too, I think, you know, if we look at also so there's like the collaborator part, but then also solving the mystery. That for me is always an important part. It's not just important for him because he's very invested about at the end, but also for the reader. We always sort of maintain that the joy of crime and mystery is can get as dark as you want, and people sort of seem to respond to that in almost like a cathartic sense. But what I think you need to do, and even if the endings are sort of grey endings where it's not clean cut, it's not black and white, it's still to get that sense of answering the mystery so that people feel a sense of resolution. Even if they don't like the resolution, all the questions you've asked throughout the novel have been answered-ish, you know, not to leave with an unresolved thought. So in some ways he's mirroring, and I was thinking about the reader when I'm thinking about his desire, but I had to make it believable for that character, so his desire to want to solve the mystery. So it's sort of a balance, but I think you're right. I mean, there's sort of, by the time we finally reach the end, he's got to be careful about this collaborator label.
Mm. I feel like we've laid enough breadcrumbs now, Alex. I think we have given any genre head, any lover of literature, a reason to go and pick up The Paris Collaborator. I began the conversation by saying I expected this beautiful journey in my mind, travel when I can't travel, and I ended up moving through so many of the important ideas that vex us today. And I did all that reading The Paris Collaborator from A.W. Hammond. Alex, thank you so much for joining me on the show, for taking us through your latest book.
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew. I had a great time. I enjoy the deep dives that you do on the podcast. It's a rare and enjoyable experience.
Storybox is a clean energy digital cube made for storytelling in outdoor spaces. With a residency in Darling Square until June 30, Storybox invites storytellers and future dreamers to share their imaginary vision of a Sydney that has learnt to care for people and planet. Share your vision in less than 100 words and see your words light up on Storybox. For more information, go to storybox.co/climatefutures. Storybox sponsors 2SER.
This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. I'm Andrew Popel. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you also to A.W. Hammond, who joined me. We were discussing his new novel, The Paris Collaborator. Get into it. Like, I thoroughly recommend this from sort of an entertaining historical perspective, but also that philosophical kind of get into the thinking. If you missed that conversation, check it out on the podcast. If you haven't listened into the Final Draft podcast lately, there is so much great stuff there. There's lots of bonus, including the 2SER book club and bonus features that don't make it to air. So check it out. Right now, though, I am going to leave you with a track. This is from Sydney band Infinity Broke. It's called Death of a Tourist. I will be back with more Final Draft next week. Thanks for joining me. See you later. And always, happy reading. Bye now.
Join them, not to rush, but he thought better of it. Stan said, thanks, I should be off, I should be
Wanted to try your hand at being a detective? Solve a few murders? Death of the Reader is diving into interactive fiction so you can put your own eyes on the case and see how you stack up to Sherlock. Sundays at 9 p.m, Thursdays at 7:30 p.m, or on any of your favorite podcast apps, it's time to crack open your computer and solve a crime. Your Murder Mystery World Tour, here on 2SER 107.3.